Just before I start, so I haven't started yet, just wanted to say how excited I've been when I've heard about what's been happening over these last few weeks. Many of you who know me will know how key prayer is in my own life, and how for many years now, a good number of years, I've made it number one in my day. And yet I have actually sometimes, this may really surprise you, and no names, no patril, but there have been times where I've been discouraged from praying. I mean, literally, have been told that there are more important things or that you can't spend time praying. And so I've kind of fought it, said, yes, it is. It is the most important thing. So I've really been excited to hear Rupert saying it's important. And I'm saying again as well, it is key. He said something, Rupert's been speaking over the last few weeks, and by the way, I back up. It's very difficult to promote your own sermons, your own messages, but actually I'm going to do it for Rupert's sake. Listen to those MP3s. If you've not been here, listen to that teaching. He said something, he said, unless we encounter Jesus at a deeper level, all the Sermon on the Mount, and that's just the series that Rupert's taking through, but it applies to all the teaching, everything we know just becomes a new legalism unless we encounter Jesus at a deeper level. I'm hoping that part of what I could do this morning is to take us as well, as we have been doing, to a deeper level of knowing Jesus. That's what all this is about. And prayer is the key. It really is the key. It's lovely sharing together the Northumbria liturgy. I know some of us here have been touched and linked with Northumbria community for a long time. So to have the liturgy as part of our gathering together is very exciting, and it's been lovely to share that. I know we haven't finished it yet because we're going to do the end bit at the end, but I just wanted to say thank you to God for what's been happening, and to encourage and say it is really important. It really is the key, the purpose, the meaning. I'm going to be talking a lot about that this morning. Okay. Oh yes. Can I have the other mic? I'm running about here like a mad thing. Okay, thank you. And Johnny, would you come and help me? I know you've been up here already. I know you, oops, you're not. No, I'm not going to do anything silly, honest. Could I have the first word, Stephen? Just that word up there. There is a point to all this. No, don't go away. Honestly, I'm not going to embarrass you. Now, you're looking at a word, Johnny. I want you to tell me, as you look at that word, what you're thinking. Eh? Is it on?
Eh?
Okay. Yeah? Anything else?
No idea what it is, and hope you'll ask me to see it.
Okay, you've no idea what it is. That's fine. So you're asking yourself what?
Why have you put it there?
Why have I put it there? Are you interested at all in what it means?
Not massively.
Okay. Sorry. This is not where it was intended to go.
You asked the mathematician, you asked the wrong guy.
If you see a... Yeah, that's true, I did. I asked you your reactions. But if you see a new word and you don't know, what's the first question you ask yourself? Anyone?
Sometimes, what does it mean if I want to know?
Aha, okay, if you want to know, you ask what it means. Let me give you a clue. Let me give you a clue now. Would you put the next word up? Does that help?
Is it something to do with food?
Uh-huh. What's the second word?
Wit. Oh, dinnerwit.
Dinnerwit. Okay, that's what the first word means. So we're getting somewhere towards the meaning of this first word.
Not that much closer.
No closer.
This is not actually about the word. What the word means is not the key. It's how we get to the meaning of words. Joanne, do you know what the word means? Someone who? Yeah, that's it. That's where the wit comes from. What it actually means is someone who's a very good talker at dinner. Dipnon is the Greek word for dinner. And sophist is someone who really comes into their own when they've had a glass of wine and a nice meal, and suddenly they are the talk of, you know, the life and soul of the party. Thank you, Johnny. That's great. All right. Just put the next thing up there, Stephen. We ask ourselves, whenever we see a new word, if we want to know, I agree, Johnny. But if it was part of your work, for instance, you came across a word you don't know, you need to know what it means. Not only what does it mean, but what is its context? What does this word mean, but where do I use it? One other question. Actually, Johnny, just take that back. Just for a second. How do you know what I've just told you is true?
Because I believe everything you say.
Silly man. No, actually, that is part of the answer, is that accepting meaning, also there's an aspect of trust within it. I know the explanation's true, not because I have all the proof. You haven't gone to a dictionary or you haven't gone to a lexicon online and worked it out for yourself. You've accepted what I'm telling you is true. So there's an aspect of relationship. There's actually an aspect in it of revelation, because you're taking it from me to you. Something in my bag here. I'm a volunteer now. Let me see. Everyone's going panicking now. Is it going to be me? Is it going to be me? Joe. Yeah. Come and help me. Joe is... Just back from Israel. Well, Baruch Haba. Welcome back. And
Toda Rabba.
And we will not do this. We'll not go there. But you're now, if I remember rightly, you're in aeronautics, aren't you?
Yeah.
You do aeronautics. Yes. Okay. And you're about to go. You are about to go to Cambridge.
Yep. On Thursday.
Sorry.
On Thursday.
On Thursday. Blessings on you as you go. And you're going to be studying there, furthering your whole aeronautical engineering and pursuing your studies. Okay. I want to give you an object. Okay. Right. Now, I want you to ask me some questions about the object. What are the thoughts? What do you want to know?
Is it a rudimentary coat hanger?
No, ask me a question. Ask me questions. No, it's not.
What's it for?
It's black.
What's the colour?
No, keep asking the same question.
Okay. What's it for?
It weighs 240 grams.
What's it for?
It's made of cast iron.
What's it for?
Are you getting the idea here? Just... No, you're not. Just by knowing the facts about something doesn't give you the purpose or the meaning. I'll help you a little bit. It's a lever. It is, but you knew that. Thank you. Thanks, Joe. It is, and that's because Alan knows it was off my wood-burning stones. He's probably got one himself. Here it is in use. It's right, strangely, that little... This is the thing in the end that goes into the handle that pulls it up, that opens the door when it's too hot to touch. And this one, next picture, goes in the top and opens the flue and closes the flue. But even an aeronautical engineer couldn't tell me what that was without revelation, without communication. And I suppose the other question which I asked Johnny is, how do you know what I tell you is true? And I've shown you a picture, but actually it's because you trust me. You trust me. One last illustration. Would you just mind drinking that glass of water for me, Liz? Well, just you don't have to drink all of it, just a little bit of it. Thank you. That's all you needed to do. Now, Liz, how do you know that wasn't poisoned?
I'm still speaking.
And I offered you the glass of water and you drank it. What was going on there?
I panicked slightly. Wondering if it would taste differently or something, if there's going to be some kind of surprise.
So why did you let me give you a glass of water?
Because I'm obedient.
Oh, okay, that'll do. I wasn't going to get to obedience just now. There was a point to all that. And it's also, if I can put words in Liz's mouth, and that came out earlier, she trusts. There's an element of trust. Even though I gave her a glass of water, it could have been sulfuric acid. I mean, it wouldn't have been in the glass long if it had been sulfuric acid, but you know, it could have been something harmful. But because we trust one another, because Liz trusts me, there's an element in which I can give that. Now, turn to John 1. There is a point to all this. It's not to read from the scriptures. And I've got to stick to my notes, because otherwise I go all over the place. Lost it again. I'm going to read from the contemporary English version. In the beginning was the one who's called the Word. The Word was with God and was truly God. From the very beginning, the Word was with God. And with this Word, God created all things. How many things? How many things? Say it like you believe it. All things. Nothing was made without the Word. Everything that was created received its life from Him, and His life gave light to everyone. The light keeps shining in the dark, and darkness has never put it out. God sent a man named John who came to tell about the light and to lead all people to have faith. John wasn't that light. He only came to tell about the light. The true light that shines on everyone was coming into the world. The Word was in the world, but no one knew Him. Although God had made the world with His Word, He came into His own world, but His own nation didn't welcome Him. Yet some people accepted Him and put their faith in Him, so He gave them the right to be the children of God. They weren't God's children by nature or because of natural desires. God Himself was the one who made them His children. The Word became a human being and lived here with us. We saw His true glory, the glory of the only Son of the Father. From Him, all the kindness and the truth of God have come down to us. I've lost count of the number of times that we read all in that chapter. I've been on holiday and I read two books on holiday. One was the last Rebus novel. It's a bit sad, Exit Music. But you know, it's a depressing series of books, really. I love Rankin's writing, but I always come away from it feeling like, oh, Edinburgh is such a dire place. And the underworld and the overworld and all he talks about. Although he's pretty accurate, I'm afraid. But then the other book I read was a book by... Actually, I'd seen Fred Drummond of Evangelical Alliance reading it. It was in his office in Glasgow, and he said that he was reading it. And you know, the Holy Spirit sometimes provokes you to read something. I don't know if it does with you, but He provokes me. And I just had to get hold of this book, even though I didn't really know the contents of it. And it's by Leslie Newbegin, Bishop Leslie Newbegin, who's a great ecumenist, member of the World Council of Churches, started off a Presbyterian and became a bishop in South India, in the South Indian Church, and was a great... communicator and a great explainer of the gospel and how we can bring the gospel to our modern society and pluralist societies. And so I got hold of this book and I've read it three times now. It's not a long book, it's only 100 pages. But I was so impacted, and a lot of what comes out of what I want to share this morning has to do with some of the things he's saying. I've tried to distill it down, and my fear this morning is that it gets an intellectual exercise rather than comes from our heart. So I want to say this morning that what I want is... I just realised I'm using this. I've got this on. Thank you. I'm using both. That's bad. I don't need that. Belt and braces. So I want it to come from the heart more than from the head. In the beginning was the Word. Now, what came out of what we just saw from Johnny's interaction, from Joe's interaction, is that Word is not enough. You know the great Lewis Carroll, who wrote Alice in Wonderland, wrote the beginning of that wonderful poem, Jabberwocky, 'twas brillig, and the slithy toves did gyre and gimble in the wabe. All mimsy were the borogroves, and the mome raths outgrabe. It means nothing. It's nonsense. I think there are certain meanings you could put in the words, and there have been sort of philosophical treatises done on what he was trying to talk about. But it's nonsense. You can have a word that has no meaning. But this word, the Word, must have the meaning. If it's the word that God has spoken, it must be the meaning. And this is what happened. This is what hit me like a 10-ton truck. Shirley, did I knock it over? Did I say, Shirley, can he knock it over? Yes, he can, and he just did. Thank you. That was almost destined to happen. Even though I put it... Right. Lost my thread there. What hit me like a 10-ton truck was this. When it says, in the beginning was the word, what God is actually saying is, in the beginning was the meaning. The meaning. This word, when John uses it in the Greek, it wasn't the first time a Greek speaker would have come across it, or a learned Greek speaker would have come across it. The logos is the word in the Greek. Logos doesn't just mean word, it means a whole reality structure. It means the whole ultimate reality of the universe. Plato had used it, Aristotle had used it. The most recent person to have used it that John would have known was a Jewish Greek-speaking philosopher called Philo. And he talked about the logos to describe the mind of God and the thinking of God. And so this ultimate reality was known about. The only key thing was that it wasn't personal. This logos, according to the philosophers, according to Philo, wasn't personal. But the most cataclysmic thing that John writes in that first chapter of his gospel is the word became flesh. Keo logos sarx, Eianeto, he actually writes in the Greek. Sarx, it became like you and me, it became flesh. And he is Jesus Christ. Now this was a complete offence to all thinking people. How could what was out there, how could what was in the spiritual, how could what was the ultimate ideal out there, how could it have anything to do with matter? The Greek way of thinking was dualistic. It kept apart mind and matter. It kept apart spirit and the world. And so to say the word, the logos, becomes flesh, was actually offensive. But what John is saying, and this is what hit me like a 10-ton truck, is that in Jesus Christ, the meaning of the universe becomes personal, and he becomes a person. And everything that God wants to say, and everything that God means, is in him. I had a strange experience this week. I was sitting on a bus, actually, and I was looking out on the street, and there was a guy standing on the corner, just an ordinary guy. And I looked at the guy, and I thought, what would it be like if that was Jesus standing there? If he was God? And it was a really strange thing. I thought, he's just, a 6 foot, 2 arms, 2 legs, Western clothes, haircut. But what if that were Jesus? What if that was God? How could that possibly be? So it's a cataclysmic statement that John is making, that ultimate reality, this meaning of the universe, has become a person. Now, I have to tell you, folks, that as Christians, we are way out on a limb here in the light of other faiths in the world. Other faiths in the world either say that ultimate reality is impersonal, that there is a nothingness out there that we are supposed to be part of. So the idea of karma, the idea of the one out there somewhere, but actually is nothingness, really, and that our purpose is to become one with the nothingness and get away from all this material stuff. Or there are those out there who say that we cannot know God, that God is there, but actually he doesn't have a relationship with us. And we can't have a relationship with him. He's too high and holy to have anything to do with us. As Christians, we are really messing that whole thing up by saying that God is man in Jesus Christ, and that the meaning of the universe is contained in him. We can't stand on a level playing field with any other faith when we say that, because the other faiths reject it, say it can't be true. We're saying something very key. He breaks all the rules. He breaks all the rules. That's why Paul says to the Greeks, it's an offense. To the Jews, it's a stumbling block. How can this be possible? This is a quote from Leslie Newbegin's book. The ultimate reality, which is the object of all our search for truth, has been made present in the person and work of Jesus Christ. The Word was made flesh and dwelt among us, and we beheld his glory. There's something also key about how we know. Now, I'm talking to 21st century people who live in a liberal, humanist, democratic society. I know we may not call ourselves that, but that's what we live in. That's our milieu. That's the culture around us. If we lived in Saudi Arabia, we'd be living in an Islamic society. Where we are here, we're living in a liberal, humanist, democratic society that doesn't accept the kind of things I'm talking about. So actually, how we know, a lot of what we've been educated in is that way of thinking. But the Christian way of understanding, knowing, is not about things. It's not just about knowledge. It's not just about having facts. It's about relationship. Many languages in the world have two words for knowing. Those of you who know French, I met Amy this morning who's studying French and German. Where are you, Amy? Give me a wave. They're going to embarrass you now. Amy's over there. She's just starting French and German. And you'll know that French has savoir and connaître. Savoir for knowing things, connaître for knowing people. German also has two words, wissen for knowing things and kennen for knowing people. And there are many words. We don't do that in English. And interesting enough, Greek didn't either. But to know Christ is not just to know here. You can know all the facts about God, you can know all the facts about Jesus, but if you don't know him, you're missing it. And so this whole idea of knowledge as relationship and not just a list of facts is really key. And there's something else about that kind of knowledge takes control out of our hands. For example, I say, I know Tim, right? I know Tim, I've known for a little while, but actually, I don't know everything about him. I don't know what he had for breakfast this morning. I don't know how well he slept last night. I could ask you. But you see, those kind of things about knowing Tim are out of my control. It's also risky knowing Tim. It's also risky knowing anyone, because we can't get all the facts. I know he isn't, but Tim could be an axe murderer. You know, and I go out here and he comes after me. You're not, are you? He comes after me with an axe. But that's the risk I take in getting to know someone else. And so in knowing Jesus, in knowing this meaning of the universe, it's not on the level of knowing the facts. It's risky. But I have to say that by and large, man, particularly Western man, has rejected that. Man actually today says that we can know reality, we can know meaning by knowing facts. Not God, not traditions, that we can know God. Now, a lot of that comes from a guy who I'm not going to get into all his thought, but his name's Descartes, René Descartes. And in 1628, one Friday afternoon, he decided to go, and it was raining outside or something. He sat in his room and he decided that he was going to doubt everything. He was going to cut himself off from every tradition, and he was going to doubt and doubt and doubt until he got to the irreducible, indubitable. That means he couldn't doubt it. Indubitable means he couldn't doubt it. The indubitable certainty of everything. And what did he come up with? What was the only thing he couldn't doubt? Thinking as himself. I am. I think. Therefore, I am. And what Descartes did was he made himself and man the center of his universe. And this mind becomes a theatre of reality. And from Descartes and others after him, Newton, you know, Newton, godly man though he was, said that we can work everything out by mathematics. That everything can be known, everything can be understood, the meaning of the universe can be found through mathematical formulas. And there are still people who are trying to do that. If you can only get the right mathematical formula, you will find out the meaning of the universe. Reminds me of Douglas Adams' thing, you know, what's the answer to 42? What's the question? You can't know both things. But anyway, that this is the idea that Descartes had, that if I doubt everything, I can come to certainty. Another quote from Leslie Newbegin: Descartes bequeathed to Europe a confidence that certain knowledge could be achieved without reference to God. But if the biblical story is true, the kind of certainty proper to a human being will be one which rests on the fidelity of God, not upon the competence of human power. Think about it for a moment. Does anybody here know anything without it having been taught to them? The meaning of it, I mean. Whatever we learn, we receive. It's communicated to us. It's a kind of revelation. We're schooled and we're trained in it. But we've been turned into, man, Western man particularly, has been turned into what I want to call a doubting race. So Descartes taught us everything is to be doubted, and only indubitable certainty, only the things you can't doubt are to be trusted or are to be allowed. However, what if there's no such thing as objective certainty? Who here is really objective? Who here can step outside their own tradition, their own family, their own training, their own background, their own childhood, and think without all those things that they're made up of? Answer: impossible. You can't. What we can do is we can get... Sorry, everyone learns by trusting what they're taught. So belief is actually something key to knowing. And this is what our dear old friend Augustine found out back in the 4th century when he said, or 5th century, when he said, I believe in order to know. I believe in order to know. Like you trusted the word, the meaning of the word I told you, like you trusted that I wasn't giving you a glass of poison. You believe in order to know. And that's what we all do all the time, despite what we may be told by the present age. We're told that facts are what we need. But we've just found out, helpfully, with Joe there, that facts don't give us meaning or purpose. We're surrounded by technology and science. We're given more and more things that will enable us to do more and more stuff. But I have to say, they still have not given us the meaning and the purpose of the universe. And there's one other terrible thing that is going on that we have to acknowledge, is that if I only know all the facts, and if I only have all the things that the facts give me, but I don't have the meaning and the purpose, eventually what it leads me to is a terrible thing called nihilism. Nihil is the Latin word for nothing. And it means that I'm headed for nowhere and nothing. And so actually, it makes sense to end it when it gets too much. In terms of the liberal humanist democratic philosophy, euthanasia makes sense. It's a horrible thing to say, but actually, if you follow that philosophy, that's the end of it. Put a stop to it when it gets too painful, because there's no meaning or purpose in it. So while as Christians we should be saying that's not what it's about, at the same time, I don't believe we're actually going to stop it. It's already happening in places in the world that follow this kind of philosophy. This is the terminal point of Descartes' understanding. This is the terminal point of man's belief in certainty without God. It's crippling. It's demonic. It's not Jesus. Because Jesus is the meaning of everything. We don't believe it. We really don't believe it. I don't believe it. We have been so schooled and pushed into a place of accepting that facts and things and stuff and matter, material, are what matter around us, that if we get more stuff, if we get more things, if we get more gadgets, if we get bigger houses, if we get bigger cars, if we get a nice pension, that we'll somehow be safe. And yet you come to the end of some people's lives, to their funeral, and what have they got? People saying nice things about what they did a few weeks ago or a couple of years ago or at the beginning of their life, but no hope, no future, because they've refused the meaning and the purpose of everything. That is Jesus, not just for us. We're in a very dangerous position because we have our meaning. But we let people out there say, oh, I have my meaning and my meaning counts for me. What meaning? What hope? Just ask some people, even this week, even these next few days, what's your hope? I don't just mean for this life, but what's your hope for the future, for the purpose of your life? So many people don't know because they don't know Jesus. And for us, it means renewing our trust in him. That's why I've been so excited hearing what Rupert's been saying about Jesus, encountering Jesus, renewing our trust in him. The meaning. I want to take that word. It's one of these, you know how frustrated I get with English translations of the Bible. You know, for centuries we've lived with this word, which doesn't translate what the Greek meant. A Greek, John, when he wrote it, he knew that the Greeks had this whole understanding of logos and what it meant, ultimate reality, purpose, meaning. And John says the meaning became flesh. So I would like to change, say the meaning is God, the meaning is Jesus. And that's what we have to give to people. That's what we have to share with them, more than just sharing. We have to live that. And that means renewing our trust. The meaning became flesh and lived among us. And he calls us to trust him. To trust him. This is where trust is so key. But as modern Western liberal humanist school people, we won't trust until we've got the facts. You tell me what your prospects are. You tell me what this is going to involve. You tell me what this is going to cost. You tell me, and then I'll make a decision based on my analysis of all the facts you've just told me. When Jesus came to those fishermen by the Lake of Galilee, he didn't give them a CV, he didn't give them a resume, he didn't give them a health and safety assessment, he gave them nothing. He just said, follow me. And when they set out and walked after him, it was in complete and utter trust. And you know what? Within 3 years, it all went belly up. They found themselves one Thursday night with their leader, who told them to follow him, arrested, in prison, condemned to death, them scattered. All the things he said seemed to be going up in smoke. The facts, brothers and sisters, at that point pointed to they'd been deceived. They'd been lied to. The invitation there was almost not to trust. But they held on. At least the women did. Notice it was the women who went to the tomb, not the men. The men were all sitting having a, you know, what do we do now party. The women went to the tomb. And Jesus comes again, and he renews, he transforms. Joe was sharing with us about this transformation. Resurrection is where we are headed. That's the meaning. That's what will happen to the whole universe, the Christian belief is. That there will be a death, because Jesus died as the meaning of the universe. Jesus died, but he rose again to eternal life in holiness. And that is where the universe, not just you and me, but that's where the universe is destined to go. And that's why Jesus is so key to our understanding of reality and what reality is about. Jesus says, follow me. Jesus says, take it on trust. As you've been taking stuff I've been saying on trust this morning, he says, take it on trust. I just read the other week through the book of Job again in my readings, and Job is a fascinating book because most of the book of Job is rubbish. God says that at the end. Most of what those friends of Job say to him, yeah, they've got a lot of good philosophy and there's a lot of good learning in there. I do encourage you to read it, by the way. But actually, they're coming up with loads and loads of facts that they know about God. And you've got to do this and you've got to do that. And God does this and God does that. But what they've missed, the key thing about Job they've missed, is the relationship. And that it all starts at the beginning of Job with God saying to Satan, I love Job so much and Job loves me so much that no matter what happens to him, however horrible it gets, he will not give up on our relationship and I will not give up on him. And for about 30 or something odd chapters, that's how the book unfolds. And all his friends are saying, oh, Job, you must have been naughty. You must have done terrible things to have that happen. Oh, God's going to punish you, Job. God's like that. God's a punisher. God's a God of justice and vengeance. He's going to screw you into the ground, Job. And by the end of it, God says, why do you bring all these facts that mean nothing? It's the relationship. And Job is restored. It's the knowing by relationship. It's this relationship with Jesus that we are invited to that bring the meaning. We're going to have a time just of receiving this word, receiving this meaning. I want to ask this morning, there may be people sitting here today and you've never caught the meaning of Jesus. That it's not really made sense to you until today. Or maybe you've never heard what I'm talking about before. And you've been living out of facts and you've been living out of happenings and things and stuff. And Jesus invites you this morning. He says, follow me. Know me. If you know me, you'll be free. If you know me, you'll have life. If you know me, you will have meaning and you'll have purpose. And then a question for those who know him. Am I living from trusting Christ? Am I living from him as the meaning of God, the ultimate reality? Or am I living by worldly patterns of proof? Do you know you can even use Descartes' methods to prove the Bible? It's what a lot of people are doing. It's called fundamentalism. It tries to reduce the Bible to indubitable certainties that actually God didn't intend putting in there in the first place. That's not saying God isn't reliable, but the way we know God is through relationship, not by Descartes' methods of rationality. You can't apply them in the same way. Am I allowing doubt in any way to become an obstacle to my trusting Jesus? I get so, so burdened and confounded when people say, I've given up on God, and I'm going to live without him. And they go off and live life without him. I say, how is that possible? What kind of relationship have you had with God that you can treat him like a book or a method of lifestyle that you put aside? I don't know how that's possible. I'm not putting myself in a place. I could never be like that myself. But it's just strange. It's because doubt becomes an obstacle. And if I have been, can I stop treating God as an object? Can I stop treating Jesus as an object, as an impersonal reality, and trust him as my Father? And will I live out Christ's life, the meaning that is carried in each one of us? You and I have living within us the meaning of the universe. Let that sink in a moment. The purpose of the universe resides in each one of us and in all those who follow Jesus Christ. That's what we're saying. It's preposterous. It's arrogant. It's offensive. It's bigoted. Those are all the words you'll hear when you say that. But it's true, if we really believe it. Brothers and sisters, that's why others who've gone before us have died through the centuries in flames and by sword, because they wouldn't give up this belief in Jesus as the meaning of everything, even though they were persecuted for it. Our response this morning, I'm just going to invite us to look in a moment at a picture of Jesus. And in fact, let's put the picture up there, and I'll just give these responses. Do you want to meet the meaning of the universe this morning? Do you want to encounter the purpose for which you were created? Dwell on him for a moment. This is not a photograph, by the way. This is just an impression, one that helps me personally. Can we repent of the belief that facts are enough and that our human reason can work it all out? Our reason is the biggest idol in our Western world. Reason and rationality has kept us away from God. Can we repent of that and believe on Christ as the personal meaning of God and of life and grow in him? And can we commit to living out the meaning and purpose in a world that tells us there is none? Out there on the Alpha poster, there's an invitation this week and the weeks ahead for people to explore with us the meaning of life. It's Jesus. Let me just take a couple of minutes, maybe just a few minutes in quietness, just to contemplate the word, the meaning made flesh, the meaning made man in Christ, and what that means to us.